talk about wattles and acacia. Let's talk about whatever we want to in the sort of second March. Is this the March or is this the April podcast, Trevor? And welcome to Two Peas in a Podcast.
Thank you very much, Michelle. I'm quite happy to be here on the last day of March.
Last day of March. April Fool's tomorrow.
April Fool's tomorrow. Yeah. But the interesting thing is the climate hasn't really changed. It's been splendid this year to live in, hasn't it?
It has been utterly delightful. The mornings are getting darker, but not a lot cooler. So I'm sort of going on my morning walk at about 6 o'clock, which I like to do. It's quite dark, and I kind of make sure I go up the main street, but it's not freezing, which is lovely.
Yeah,
I just got like a bit of a wind cheater, and it's, I mean, I kind of get a bit of a brisk walk up with the dog, but it's actually gorgeous.
After you, but I put in my carrots, radish, silver beet, beetroot, peas, and four types of lettuce, but I'm running a bit behind you, although I think I actually might have a few more.
But I only look good because a lot of my garden is just, it's sick of waiting for me to plant it, so it's gone rogue. So we're actually podcasting from my garden today, and Trevor's had a bit of a look around, and it's gone a little bit rogue, but it's gone beautifully rogue, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, she has anticipated part of this podcast, and that she has covered the ground thoroughly in organic matter, so she got... Well, it's not exactly compost, but it is heavy-duty mulch, and it's so thick everywhere that you walk on it, and it's spongy.
I need that because I'm terrible at putting my shoes on in the garden. I'm not going to lie. I'm actually really awful at it, and I quite like barefoot gardening, and I shouldn't because, I broke my toe doing that.
No, but still, I think you're entitled to. And it certainly produces a very lush-looking garden, doesn't it?
It does. It looks like you've been really busy when you haven't.
Well, I think it does do a good job of keeping everything damp, you know. I'm looking at your hollyhocks and stuff now, and there's beautiful flowers, your lemons. Everything actually looks lush.
Yeah.
And that's the advantage of about 20 years of keeping adding compost to the ground.
Which, to be honest, is all I've done, as you well know. And, I mean, when you think about when I first moved here, there was so much cow trough and rubbish, and that was hard to get rid of that. And the soil was so fine and porous that nothing, like, it just wouldn't even hold water.
Yeah, true.
So, and I'm one of those people who it took me a long time to realise that if I actually wanted a really nice garden, I really had to get over myself and
the first thing I noticed when I met you was that you had a compost pile just behind you to the left.
That's true. I always like men to look at my compost pile. But, no, that's true, and I think I just kept adding, and I had to add so much manure and compost and greenery because the ground, it was awful. A lot of the compost is also the dead plants that didn't survive being planted when the soil wasn't ready, and that's the reality of it.
We've all got that. Any rate, I have planted peas, and I think the best crop for winter is peas.
Oh, absolutely.
I think in summertime... Tomatoes, corn, and a whole lot of things are pretty nice in summertime, but in winter, broccoli maybe.
Yeah.
Strawberries maybe, but strawberries you tend to pick in spring. But of all the crops, peas are the best because you can actually go on buying a frozen pea from the supermarket. We don't mind because to cook, they're fine. They don't seem to lose their taste.
No, they don't actually, true.
But if you want to forage from your trellis or forage from your ground, the pea is absolutely beautiful. You just take the peas out of the pod. In the case of snow peas and sugar snap peas, you eat pod and all.
Yeah.
And that is delicious way. And the kids love it too. So you can teach your kids to be out in the garden foraging and eating good food. It's high protein, low fat, very good food.
Well, for the tiny goddess, my little granddaughter will be moving in a few weeks while they wait for their home to be ready. And so I am looking forward to doing a bit of that garden foraging. And you know what's really lovely? There's a beautiful quote that says, you know, the problem with today's world is no one sits on the front veranda and shells peas with grandma anymore. But it's kind of true because that's just sitting there, that really mindful activity of shelling peas, even that mindful activity, you know, broad beans, people are kind of, oh my gosh, why are you growing broad beans? But you know that sense of just kipping it, flicking it, shelling it. Yeah, it's just, you know, you often talk about the mindfulness of the garden.
Well, we still do quite a lot of that. I mean, we're still harvesting basil and you have the mindfulness of picking the leaf off the stem.
And so good.
So, yeah, we're still doing that. The other thing about peas is that we've had an exceptional year for tomatoes and a lot of people that we know have had a good crop. So you can pull down the tomatoes now, they're finishing. There's a few left. If you water them, you keep on watering, you get a few more. But pull them down and put peas in their place, because A, that is very good for the soil. It adds nitrogen to it, obviously, and it's a subtle form of nitrogen. And actually, nitrogen is getting expensive. You know how everything else in the world is getting expensive? Well, apparently urea, which is the unspeakable inorganic way of adding nitrogen, that's also used to supplement fuel, and that's running short. And so the farmers out there who use urea as their source of nitrogen are actually running out of it, and really planting peas is a way of getting it for nothing, and it's better.
Can I tell you my favourite pea recipe?
Yes.
Okay. My favourite pea recipe. I've got two pea recipes. One of them is just steam them with butter. But you know what my other one is?
No.
Like boil them with mint.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Isn't that great? Boil them with mint from the garden. Yeah. Mint from the garden.
I remember that from Christmas time.
I don't, see? Drain them and just yum. Yum. So good.
Yeah, well, none of us get to the kitchen, so you don't actually...
No, that's actually true, isn't it? It's kind of just sit there and eat them as you go. It's just, it's insane. So we're talking a bit about ground cover today because it's important. I desperately attempt to get it to get rid of my cooch and I just give up. But you're right, it is around that kind of feeding the soil. And you've been watching a new YouTube.
Yeah,
Trevor loves a YouTube.
Well, there's something called chicken composting. It's worth watching. This bloke from New York is, I sort of like, he's a good talker. He's not trained or anything, and so I like his sort of messy approach. But he gets these food scraps or waste from a couple of restaurants and a couple of other places, including a butcher, I think, and he came up with this idea of giving heaps and heaps of food to his chooks, but not paying much.
Yeah.
You see, there's a lot of ways you can do that. The first one is you can get all these food scraps and mix them with carbon. Now, carbon is really just sawdust and leaf matter, because it's autumn time, so leaves are falling, and straw and stuff like that. You add that because the food scraps, which from a restaurant are fabulous, you know, they're melted cheese and spaghetti and beans and the cabbage leaves and the lettuce leaves and the cucumbers, and all sorts of stuff thrown out. It's really, really rich.
Yeah.
So it would stink. Basically, if it were allowed to rot on its own, it would stink. But he adds all this sawdust straw and wood chips to it, and it turns into compost with the chook busily working away every 14 hours a day, he reckons they work. He's timed them. They're beautiful looking chooks. And so that's one way of, I mean, what he's doing is developing compost. But at the same time, there's a lot of people looking at not paying so much for their wheat and for their grain, for their chooks, you see. And you can easily do it. If you look at weeding, which you do, I know, you just show your weeds into them. Look at your prunings and throw them into it. Look at your lawn clippings and throw them into it. Look at your food waste and throw them into it. And keep the ground a bit wet. Well, then these chooks will turn it into compost for you.
Because they kind of, like, for me, I chuck all the weeds and everything in. It's not that they don't necessarily eat it. But like you were saying, it's an excellent breeding ground for all those bugs that they like, so that then they'll scratch that over, and then you rake it, and you've got some fantastic soil.
Yeah, I had a strange disaster in my best soil, my 20-year-old soil, which I brought up to a high standard. I put the chooks in it for 2 years, and then when I came back to it, it wasn't anywhere near as good as I thought it should be. And the reason was I applied no water, and the chooks had carte blanche, and they destroyed all life in it. They didn't destroy was died of thirst. And so I've sort of learned from that even if you have got rotating chook yards like I have, you're still going to keep the one that the chooks are in full of mulch and hiding places for the, you know, the centipedes and the millipedes and the earwigs and the slaters. So you need to keep the soil alive, and this guy is really good at telling you how to do that. The other thing he does is he encourages greenery. So you can fence off part of the yard and plant it out with wheat, millet, oats, rye, barley, anything, and then you can open it back to the chooks after 4 weeks or so, and they come in and all this green food there. And you can put things on the ground like milk crates, old cartons, pots, or wire mesh cylinders, and all of that. You can actually pile the compost and stuff inside of the cylinders, and so you can build up compost piles, and you can build up areas where the chooks can't get. And so when you lift it up, because all the chooks are very curious and they come around, they peck it all to death right away.
Oh, how cool is that?
Yeah, so you keep on moving it. You can use logs and rocks and all sorts of stuff to hide it from the chook, but then you've got to keep moving it. And he also rakes it, and he moves it into piles, so you can take it off the low stuff and move it into a pile that's higher, and that gets hotter.
I also think, Trevor, chooks are smart, and I think, like, if you've got all that stuff going on for the chooks as well, it kind of keeps them busy. It probably stops them from being mean to each other, do you reckon?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. They're also full. They're also happy. I mean, there still is that, you know, that really hilarious situation when you throw out the wheat and 12 chooks are all sort of beat down and bum up, and there's a chook that's taking out wheat bit, and then he comes to a bottom of somebody, he pecks it, and the one he pecks goes, whoa! And then they all go on pecking again. You'll see him doing that all the time. And so, yeah, they're not aggressive when they're well fed, but they still are a little bit aggressive.
Well, the pecking order. But no, give that a go. Try some different things. And I like the idea of having a whole bunch of stuff in the chook shed just to kind of create, as we talk about all the time, more wildlife in the garden.
Yeah.
Because your chooks need protein. They're not vegetarian.
Well, you won't believe this next one then, because he grows sprouts for them. Mm. So you get these metal trays that are about 50 mil high and about 300 millimetres diameter, and when you put your wheat in them, or your grain, your millet, your oats or whatever, you add water, you keep them out of the road of everything else, and they will sprout, you see? And so the wheat, which is a tiny grain, suddenly becomes an inflated soft grain, and it's got a shoot and it's got a root, and the chooks eat the lot. So if you can just look a bit ahead, you can actually have bowls of sprouts for them. It's a lot better value for your wheat than, or for any of your grain, than just grain on its own.
And you get those beautiful, which my stepfather loves, when the yolk is almost orange. It literally, and he'll be like, oh, yeah. You know, when I give them eggs, and it's sort of really funny because, you know, you give people your chook eggs, and it's really like, here, would you like a little piece of my soul? And then, I don't know that people realise that when you're giving them eggs, that really, that is a sign of great love. It's why I give them to my beautiful neighbours, but I'll give them to my stepfather, and sometimes he'll be like, the yolks weren't as orange as they were this time. What are you feeding him, Michelle? Like, what are you doing to them? You know, and he gets really like cross with me, and I'm like, well, you know, it's winter and I didn't know it's summer and I didn't have as much greenery. Well, you need to go and get some stuff. So grow your millet and your greenery. Be nice to your chooks. They're good to us. They really are.
Yeah,
you gotta
treat them like pets.
Yeah, they really. I just want to point out that Trevor didn't want me talking about chooks about a year ago, and now I've completely converted him to talking about chooks. But they are. Then you do have to treat them really kindly, because they are a really incredibly useful pet.
On the other hand, weeds. See, this is autumn and the rain hasn't come yet, so farmers are ploughing up their land, but they're not ready to plant until that rain comes. But what I did in this bed that I told you about, where I left chooks for 2 years and they virtually destroyed it, and I got it back by watering it and adding compost and all that, so now it's good again. But when you do all that, the weeds come up. So just a word of warning to people who are about to plant seed, it's not a bad idea. If the ground is vacant now, and looking a bit dry and as though it's dead, it's not. It's actually full of seed. So give it a bit of water, give it your manure and compost and whatnot, and give it a bit of water, and then give it 2 weeks and then rake it over or hoe it a second time or something, because I've planted carrots, and carrots are a bit difficult in that they're a bit slower than most things to come up. And so the weeds will easily beat them, and it's not a bad idea to get rid of the weeds. And the same thing goes for sweet peas.
Best carrots I ever had, Trevor, was 2020, when I had to work from home. I was in a different job, and I had what I called my COVID carrots, because I was working from home, and each time I took a break, I'd go out there and water the seeds, keeping them damp, and then as they grew, after a few weeks, I'd get out there and I'd get rid of all the weeds as we went along. I had the most magnificent crop of carrots.
Yeah, they were funny.
But I had to be onto it. I was onto it.
One of the things people don't realise with carrots, I mean, you go to a lot of trouble to fluff up the soil, because you know that they're a taproot and they go down where it's soft. You've got to fork over the soil. It seems counterintuitive, but oddly enough, when you're planting the seed, you're only putting about four or five mil of soil on top of those seeds.
Absolutely,
not much at all. So I use that Koya seed raising mix that is already saturated because you've brought it into being by soaking it. And then I come, unbelievably, and whack it down with the back of the rake. So you're walking along the row and you're whacking it all down. You think, well, what the hell is he doing? He just got all this trouble to fluff it up. But the soil to seed combination is what carrots like, and then you water it heavily too, yeah. And that also gets the soil to seed combination. So if you're having trouble germinating carrots, that's possibly the reason why, but you also put shade crop over it and you keep it damp for about a week.
They're kind of precious to start off with, but once they get going, seriously, they are totally, they're like potatoes. People are rude about growing potatoes. Why would you grow potatoes? They're $1 a bag, and then you give them homegrown potatoes and they go, oh my gosh, I'm so going to go grow potatoes. And I think carrots are the same. They're a bit of a pain in the neck to start off with, but they are absolutely, they are another one where you just kind of pull them out the ground. I remember my granddaughter, you know, we'd pull them out the ground, we'd wash it, and she'd be following us around the yard, munging down on them, because they're sweet. They're really, really sweet when they're pulled straight from the garden.
Better than the commercial ones, yeah.
Really sweet. They're fantastic.
That's about our lot. We've got heaps of other things we can talk about. We were going to talk about native plants, but this is going to be an ongoing conversation.
I think it is going to be an ongoing conversation. So I took Trevor for a bit of a walk around the garden, and I am slowly converting, and I have to avoid doing that thing that I do, Trevor, where I suddenly go, I'm really obsessed with this thing, and I pull up all my plants and just plant native. So I'm trying to be a nice balance. But I've got native hollyhocks, which are, they're gorgeous, aren't they? They're looking really lovely.
Oh, yeah.
The native thyme is beautiful, but I recently bought some sweet appleberry, some muntry. People have heard of muntries, and native mint. Now, native mint is actually really difficult. So I know Nita and I had this conversation. It's called green mint bush. It's actually endangered, and it is a really, really difficult mint to grow, but it's lovely. A lot of the native plants taste a little differently, but I was talking to my daughter-in-law about how I'm trying to have a bit more of a focus on it, and I said, what I have noticed, and this is just purely my observation, but that's what us gardeners do, we observe, is that, and I still plant things that aren't native, of course, because I think it's important to have a balance. Yeah, we're all learning about it. Is what I'm really loving is that what I'm noticing is that as I'm including more native plants in the garden, or more indigenous to the area in the garden, my other plants are doing better. And I sort of said to my daughter-in-law, it's really weird. Like, and she was like, yeah, of course, Mum, because they're doing so well. They're changing the structure of the soil. They're actually kind of create an environment where everybody does better, which I kind of really loved. I love that analogy. Yeah. But I'm particularly excited about the fact that I bought an appleberry, because I'd seen that watching Gardening Australia, which is, look, honestly, I don't know if we're allowed to advertise shows, but I'm going to. It's an hour of joy, and there's some really, really great inspirational advice on there. So when I finally came across an appleberry, I was like, right, I'm growing this appleberry. And so it's around putting things in and giving them a go. But the reality is we need to keep planting more of these plants. Because yes, they do better. Make sure you plant for your area.
Yep.
Because what you can plant in Gawler is very different to what you plant in Goolwa, for example.
Yep.
But the other thing is the appleberry is, it's like a climber. It's a non-aggressive climber, which is, I think, really important. Sometimes we plant these plants and we go, oh, that's really lovely. It'll take this spot over. My neighbour in the back of me planted a morning glory vine because he went, oh, that'll grow really quickly. Let me tell you, he was not my friend after that. I was just like,
no, very quickly.
Oh, it was awful. But it was also, what I love about the appleberry is that you can grow it as a climber, but you can grow it as a ground cover.
Yeah, it will form a bush, they say there.
Yeah, so
I have one of those too. I'm looking for a few. I'm 1 or 2 metres high. My garden actually lacks a bit of height, to be honest with you. It's fairly new. It's on its third year, coming up to its fourth year. So the height is good in a garden. And
yeah, I like those layers. I think that's really important.
You sort of inherited height, so you
know. Yeah, I know. I've got this huge tree.
You should really talk about your tamarillo. That is tamarillo, folks, is one fabulous looking tree. Everyone who looks at it suddenly drops jaws, you know. It's a jaw-dropping look of a standard sort of tree. I think it's very good. So tamarillo, isn't it?
Yes, the tamarillo, it's fantastic.
Mm. Yeah.
But certainly, I guess, interspersing those native plants, those indigenous plants is probably the word we should be using. What I really, really love is what I have noticed about the plants is that there is year-round experience. So you might have your fruit So, for example, my Indigenous Thyme, which is a fantastic bush.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got my thyme, but it's got the most exquisite flower. So when it flowers, it's like, oh, wow, this is really gorgeous. I mean, so does, I guess, ordinary thyme, but it seems a little bit more hardy, and it's kind of taking up this really lovely spot in my garden. So we will be talking a bit more, as we are each week, about our exploration. I guess it's around just not being afraid to give things a try.
Yeah, I've got quite a few wattles. The Flinders Ranges are a sort of weedy pest, but where we are, if you stop watering something, it dies.
Yeah.
So it's not as much of a pest here as it is otherwise. A very good sunscreening. The Cootamundra wattle too, it grows about 6 metres. I did have it growing up in the Adelaide Hills when I was there. It's got yellow ball flowers in winter, so it's actually a winter flower. And it's it has a fairly long lifetime. So the wattles are all worth looking at. I also got to say the bottle brushes are worth looking at.
And waratahs. I love bottle brush waratah grevillea, but the bottle brushes are... I had two exquisite bottle brushes when I moved in about 20 years ago. And, yes, somebody in an enthusiastic moment chopped them all down, and I've yet to forgive them. But I love bottle brushes because, once again, as we talk about attracting wildlife to the garden.
But we also talk about plants that... You know, they just about come again. You know, they almost die and then come back. You can almost not kill bottle brushes. I mean, I suggest you don't try, but they are a wonderful thing. But probably the most important thing is to prune those dead, spent flowers sort of thing. Because they do get a bit ugly if you don't
do that. Now, apparently, my daughter-in-law was telling me you can make some sort of a drink from bottle brush. Nectar, yep, you seep it. Don't do this without Googling it. Google away, but I will Google away. But she was saying you can make kind of almost a bit of a nectar from it. So I might give that a try, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's worthwhile. So, you know, my tip are the wattles and probably the bottle brushes. What are those, clistamens?
Clistamens, like, I guess I look at the ones I've put down as boundary plants, and I put them about 3 years ago. When I planted them, they were probably maybe 60 to 80 centimetres high, and within about 3 or 4 years, they're a good 2 metres.
We're using them as we got the 3 gum trees from the local area growing, and now we're filling in the lower because the gum trees themselves are well above head height. So, you know, those things are actually bird attracting, obviously.
Yeah.
So you need the flowering natives, and I think everyone's struggling a bit with the natives. I've got about 6 types of bulrush that I'm developing around the wet area. It's not easy because of cooch once again, but they are quite tough.
Yeah.
You do have to water them, you do have to spread them. I mean, you spread them by root division, I think. Well, it looks like it, you do anyway.
I've got Lamandra out the front. I'm quite a fan of the grasses.
Yeah.
Native grasses, so gorgeous. I've got them around the pond and they actually survived the fire, which was brilliant.
Yep.
Which was interesting, but I definitely want to plant some more. But give it a go. What's the worst that can happen? Nothing.
No, you can't lose. But the only thing about the natives is accumulating the knowledge to get it right.
Yeah.
That's where we're struggling, and I think... Well, even your hallowed Gardening Australia is also, you know, a lot of the presenters are very used to talking about the imported, we call them imported, but they're imported from all over the world.
Yeah.
I mean, comfrey, for instance, we were talking about comfrey today, and comfrey is apparently a good fence line thing in that the roots of the comfrey will stop other roots invading through a fence line.
They got fantastic taproot, yeah.
Yeah. So they're just a very good plant, and they've been developed, and now when you go and buy them, well, really, you can't buy anything better in the world, you see. So the stuff we're getting, not European, it's actually around the world, the stuff that we're getting. And so, you know, all around the world, they planted eucalypts. So,
well, when I was in Morocco, it was like being in Australia. Honestly, there were that many eucalyptus, and that was apparently because the Australian soldiers were bringing them over and planting them during the war.
Yeah, and I've been to Spain and California and the same.
Yep, beautiful, just gorgeous. And the smell is amazing, because in Morocco it was like really hot, and that smell was incredible. It was just, you know, and I must admit there was an element to where I kind of felt like, why have you got our trees? These are special to us. But it was great.
You do feel as though it was a bit of an invasion, but on the other hand, we've got all nationalities here as well. So we are mixing, and that's something inevitable.
I think it's fabulous. What are we going to talk about next month?
Well, we can go on just making it up as we go, because I told you about these procession caterpillars, which I've never seen before.
I know. I want to hear more about them. Talk about the procession caterpillars. Talk about it now.
They're like the woolly bears you get on a grapevine. They're these great hairy caterpillars, but they walk in a line with a leader. It's really weird. They walk across your path. They walk up your walls. They bunch together, and then they string out in a line, and they go over the pipes. They go down by the buttleys. Well, I think they were the first group ever at our place. And I think Moses did a very bad job in this case, because Moses led them to destruction, because I saw the last few bodies in my veggie garden. So somehow I think they went without food too.
Really?
They feed on wattles. Apparently wattles are their main food source. And they couldn't find any, and they died. But it was the weirdest looking thing. When you look up on a wall and there's all these hairy mammoths there, it's very strange. So, you know, we can just talk about anything, basically. I've got a lot of stuff about organics, so I think are thrashing the life out of the chemical.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's where, like, when we went back to the mulching and stuff. So next month I would have been to Cairns. Sorry, but we'll talk a little bit about rainforest plants.
Yeah, I've been to Cairns.
And what it's like when there's a ton of water. And then I also think, well, your sweet peas will be ready to be spoken about, won't they?
Yeah, we should have spoken about sweet peas today.
You're planting sweet peas.
Yeah, planting sweet peas. Yeah, that's what we say.
plant them. Yeah. And then we want to hear about it. So the beautiful smell of sweet peas just covers Gawler. What do you reckon?
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, just be wary of the fact there's not just Gawler sweet peas. There are New Zealand and English sweet peas, and they flower at different times, so you can extend the season.
Yeah.
And don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, that they are a long-stem flower for the indoors.
They are. I was getting many a posy from Trevor. It was very nice.
Well, they are. They're a beautiful thing from that point of view. And I like the way they bring the inside to life.
Yeah, I do too. They just go for so long, which is so gorgeous. So I'm going to say goodbye to my sweet pea, Trevor.
Ah, well, goodbye to my pea in the pod, Michelle.
We'll see you next month.